Ave Maria. Welcome to the History Program, a monthly series of programs produced by the Franciscans of the Immaculate for Gate of Heaven Radio. In this series, we will be looking at events in history, famous people in history, including saints and blesseds, foundations of religious orders, and much more. In short, anything in history that has a Catholic perspective. Our objective will be to tell you the facts as recorded by history. We will not be entering into polemics, nor aiming to generate any controversy. If we venture an opinion, we will say so. You are free to agree or disagree. This month's programme is entitled Mary Stuart, Scotland's Last Catholic Monarch. During my stay as a friar in England, there were some places of historical interest that I wanted to visit very much. One of these places was Peterborough Cathedral, not far from London. Peterborough Cathedral became the resting place of two famous women in history. Both of them were Catholic, and both of them were queens. One was Venerable Queen Catherine of Aragon, the wife of King Henry VIII, and her remains still rest in the cathedral. The other woman was Mary Stuart, better known as Mary, Queen of Scots, and her remains were translated to Westminster Abbey some years after her death. It is the second queen, Mary Stuart, who is the subject of tonight's programme. Much has been written about Mary Stuart over the years, and she has even been the subject of many films. So who was she? Mary Stuart was born in Scotland on the 8th of December, 1542, the only legitimate child of King James V of Scotland. Her mother, Mary of Guise, was of French noble stock. A week after Mary's birth, her father died, and so she became Queen of Scotland. However, until she became of age, the country was ruled jointly by a triumvirate, a regent, James Hamilton, otherwise known as the Earl of Arran, Cardinal Beaton, the Archbishop of St. Andrews, and acting as Queen, her own mother. Before beginning our story, we need to bear in mind that in those days, Scotland and France were allied to each other, and England was an enemy of both. The King of England, Henry VIII, and his cronies were busy looting church property in England. Many Scottish lords were doing the same thing north of the border. The religious sympathy of these Scottish lords was Protestant, and they found a willing ally south of the border in England. In 1546, Cardinal Beaton was murdered by men in the pay of the King of England, Henry VIII. John Knox, a prominent Protestant preacher, would later join up with these men. All of them were captured by French forces in the following year, 1547. In that same year, 1547, King Henry VIII of England died, as did Francis I, the King of France. Under the new French King, Henry II, French influence grew in Scotland. In 1548, the 5-year-old Mary Stuart was betrothed to the French king's heir, later to become king as Francis II. In 1554, Mary's French mother, Mary of Guise, became sole regent and ruler of Scotland. In England, in 1553, the Catholic Mary Tudor had become queen, so the Scottish rebels had ceased to be pro-English. Unfortunately, Mary Tudor's reign proved to be short-lived, and she died in November 1558. In April 1558, just 7 months before Mary Tudor's death, the 15-year-old Mary Stuart had married the French Dauphin, Francis. And in July of the following year, her husband became King of France. And so she became the Queen Consort. Let us pause from her story for a moment and take a look at John Knox. Knox had returned to Scotland in 1555, having spent time in England and abroad. He united Protestant lords under the slogan, "No more mass, death to the priesthood." The following year saw him in Geneva with Calvin. Whilst there, he wrote, "The first blast from the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women," arguing that a woman ruler was an indecency. This piece was aimed at the Catholic monarchs of England and Scotland, but it would also alienate Elizabeth Tudor against him. Before the end of 1558, Mary had married the Dauphin of France. Riots had occurred in Edinburgh, followed by a strong anti-Catholic petition to the throne. And in England, Elizabeth Tudor's reign had begun. In 1559, Mary became Queen of France, and so the King of France also became the King of Scotland. Several unsuccessful attempts had been made by the Protestant lords to hold Edinburgh. Later attempts would be driven off by French troops. In 1560, the Protestant lords secured English assistance via William Cecil. Cecil was Elizabeth's chief minister and the real power behind her throne. We will look at him in detail in a future episode of the History Programme. All was going well against the Scottish rebels until Mary of Guise took ill and died in June of that same year. Negotiations soon opened up between both sides, and a treaty was signed in July. However, the terms of the treaty were not adhered to by Knox's followers, and so the French king and queen refused to ratify it. By that stage, it was too late. Knox and his followers were now in control. A widespread destruction and theft of church property followed, along with the abolition of both the jurisdiction of the Pope and the anti-heresy laws. It became forbidden to say Mass or even to be present at Mass. For the first offence, loss of all goods and a flogging. For the next offence, banishment. For the next offence, death. It is crucial to our story to understand the family background of Mary Stuart and how, on the death of Mary Tudor, she became the rightful heir to the English throne. The historian Hilaire Belloc explains it for us. Mary Stuart was, in the eyes of her contemporaries, the legitimate Queen of England for the following reason. She was the senior legitimate descendant of an English king, to wit, Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII. Henry VII had three children who survived to have children themselves. These three children of Henry VII were Henry, who became Henry VIII, Margaret, who became Queen of Scotland, and Mary, who became Queen of France and afterwards Duchess of Suffolk. Henry VIII had two legitimate children who survived him, Mary Tudor and little Edward. Edward came first because he was a male. Mary Tudor was the next in succession, according to all the ideas and morals of the time. Henry VIII also had two illegitimate children. One, the Duke of Richmond, died young. The other, Elizabeth, survived. She was illegitimate in the eyes of Christendom, generally according to all the ideas of the time, because she was born whilst the legitimate wife of Henry was still alive, the marriage not having been declared null by competent authority, but only at the orders of Henry himself. Therefore, when Mary Tudor was dead, one had to look to the descendants of Henry VII's two daughters to find the senior representative of the blood royal. It is true that Henry VIII had made a will in which he named his successors after his own children, wherein he included Elizabeth. These successors, whom he named, were the descendants of Mary, Duchess of Suffolk, his younger sister, and he said nothing about the descendants of Margaret, his elder one. It is also true that this will was given the force of a statute by the King and Parliament. But it is false to regard the Crown of England as dependent upon a parliamentary title. That theory was invented long after. Nor could a king legally name his successor at his own caprice, though it is true that the desires of a monarch in this matter did weigh heavily at the time. What counted most with all men was the sanctity of the blood royal and the rights of seniority. Since Margaret, Queen of Scotland, was the elder daughter of Henry VII, her descendants had a prior claim. The descendants of Mary, Duchess of Suffolk, were the Ladies Grey, and it will be remembered that the elder of them, Lady Jane Grey, was made a claimant for the throne on that account, because, although she was of the junior branch, she was Protestant. Of the elder sister Margaret, the first descendant was her son, the King of Scotland. But he was dead, and the second was that son's only child, Mary Stuart. Mary Stuart was, therefore, by all the ideas of the time, the person who had a right to be Queen of England when Mary Tudor died. In December 1560, just before her 18th birthday, Mary's young husband Francis died. She was now no longer Queen of France. The following year, she returned to Scotland as Queen of Scots. She was not yet 19 years old. By the time of Mary's arrival, the particular kind of Protestantism called Calvinism had already become established in Scotland with a powerful minority, including the great Scottish lords. Matters were not helped by a marked reluctance amongst the country's Catholic majority to rally to the church's aid. And it has to be said that one reason for this reluctance was the long-standing corruption inside the Scottish church. Thus, the rebel lords found it easy enough to loot the church property. This was the turmoil in which Mary found herself when she landed in Scotland. The Jesuit historian and theologian Father Philip Hughes sets the scene for us. The mind and will of this girl, not yet 19, was the sole hope of the old religion. For this young French queen was almost alone amongst the great personages of the kingdom in her attachment to the Catholic Church as a religion, and her chances of peacefully reversing the event of 1560 were simply nil. She had neither the ability nor the experience to form a party from amongst the factions, to keep it loyal to herself, and to use it to overthrow the victorious Protestant lords. As a Catholic ruler, Mary was doomed from the day she landed in Scotland. Nor did her own ideal of toleration in religious affairs in the least avail her. And such as her power was, the time left for any exercise of it was to be brief indeed. The English concern that the hold of the Protestant lords upon the government should continue was, of course, a main factor in her fate, and the manoeuvres between Edinburgh and London were ceaseless. Unfortunately, in her own personal life, Mary was to make a few bad judgments of character. We have only time to make brief mention of them. Just a few years after her arrival in Scotland, in 1565, Mary married her cousin, Lord Darnley. A son, James, was born of the marriage. Mary began to appoint Catholics to key positions, including David Riccio, an Italian, as her chief advisor. The Protestant lords organised another rebellion, with the help from England. Darnley had become jealous of Mary's reliance on Riccio, and also on the fact that she had refused to make him king. The following year, 1566, Darnley joined up with some Protestant lords in a plan to assassinate Riccio. The assassins broke in and murdered Riccio in the very presence of Mary, with Darnley looking on. Mary was imprisoned, but she managed to escape. In 1567, 1 year after Riccio's murder, Darnley himself was murdered. Mary had taken him back and housed him. Then, early one morning, the house in which he was staying was blown up as he slept. The Earl of Bothwell was charged with Darnley's murder, but acquitted. Less than a fortnight after his acquittal, Bothwell carried Mary off by force, and she later consented to marry him. The marriage caused a great scandal, not only because she married Bothwell with Calvinistic rites, but because he was widely regarded as one of the murderers of her husband, despite his acquittal. Shortly afterwards, the same Protestant lords again rebelled against Mary. They defeated her and put her in prison, but they allowed Bothwell to escape. Mary again managed to escape. She raised an army, and in May 1568, she was defeated by the rebel lords. She was not yet 26 years of age. Mary fled across the border into England, having been promised protection by Elizabeth. There, in England, imprisonment would await her, all arranged by Cecil. Alas, for Mary, there were to be no more escapes, and she was to remain a prisoner of Elizabeth for the next 18 years. At this point, it is worth quoting from Father Hughes again, when he ponders on the opinion held by some historians, namely, that a Catholic England in the 20 years following 1559 would have meant French victories over the Protestants of France and Spanish victories over the Protestants of the Low Countries in those years. The end of Protestantism outside Lutheran Germany. And there is a corollary to this belief. Belief because, after all, it is but one of the ifs of history. Namely, that England could not have remained Protestant after 1559 if Scotland had not, about that time, itself ceased to be Catholic. Those words of Father Hughes are certainly food for thought. Cecil tried every means to blacken Mary's name, even to the extent of putting her on trial. The court, however, would not find Mary guilty. Cecil had already arranged to have her son James crowned King of Scots. Under Cecil's influence, James had been brought up as a Protestant, and he even acquiesced in the death of his own mother. His reward was that he would become King of England on the death of Elizabeth. Mary was a Catholic, and Cecil and his cronies had become rich by looting the Catholic Church. Cecil wanted to stay rich, and so he had to use every means to crush the Catholic faith in England and Scotland. Mary was in his way, and he sought a pretext for putting her to death. Mary had her faith to sustain her throughout her long imprisonment. It is comforting to note that during her captivity, Mary had been given permission by the Pope, Pope St. Pius V, to carry the Blessed Sacrament in a pyx and to administer Holy Communion to herself. This was the same Pope who would excommunicate Elizabeth I of England. In 1586, some 18 years after the capture of Mary, Cecil's spymaster Walsingham engaged an Asian provocateur to stir up a plot against Elizabeth abroad. This agent made contact with a group of English Catholics in France, headed by a young nobleman, Sir Anthony Babington. The agent provoked this group to plot the release of Mary Stuart, to put her on the throne of England, and to constrain and, if necessary, to assassinate Elizabeth. Such action, of course, amounted to high treason. Walsingham's plan was to make a case that Mary herself was party to the plot. And so a system was devised whereby letters passing from the conspirators to Mary and from her to all in the outside world could be read without her knowledge. Mr. Belloc summarises the story for us. A go-between was suborned who was supposed to be a faithful adherent of Mary's, but was really a traitor in the pay of Walsingham and his officials. In one of these letters sent by Babington, allusion was made to the killing of Elizabeth. Mary replied to it. Did she in that reply take part in the project for the killing of the reigning English queen? Walsingham said she did. But a draft of her letter, which remained in Walsingham's possession, he never dared produce. It came out that at least one very important sentence in this letter had been deliberately forged by Phillips, one of Walsingham's officials, with Walsingham's knowledge, and was not written by Mary at all. It is the sentence in which she was made to ask for a list of the names of the men who were to do the deed. It is therefore presumable that Walsingham's accusation was false, and that Mary never consented to the death of her cousin. She herself always vehemently denied it. She repeatedly challenged her prosecutors to produce the original drafts of the letters, which they refused to do. On their unsupported word, she was condemned to death. Babington and the others were arrested, tried, and executed before Mary's trial began. Execution was by the usual barbarous method, that is, hanged, drawn and quartered. During his disembowelment, Babington cried out, "Parce mihi, Domine." One of the condemned men, Chidiock Tichburn, was also an accomplished poet. He was only 24 years of age. On the eve of his execution, he wrote to his wife, enclosing a poem, an elegy. It is a good example of a literary style we call paradox, and is worth reciting it in full. My prime of youth is but a frost of cares. My feast of joy is but a dish of pain. My crop of corn is but a field of tares, and all my good is but vain hope of gain. The day is gone, and yet I saw no sun, and now I live, and now my life is done. The spring is past, and yet it had not sprung. The fruit is dead, and yet the leaves are green. My youth is gone, and yet I am but young. I saw the world, and yet I was not seen. My thread is cut, and yet it was not spun. And now I live, and now my life is done. I sought my death and found it in my womb. I looked for life and saw it was a shade. I trod the earth and knew it was my tomb. And now I live, and now I am but made. The glass is full, and now the glass is run. And now I live, and now my life is done. The 19th century English Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli would say of Tichborne, "He perished with all the blossoms of life and genius about him in the May of his existence." Mary's trial began in October of that same year, 1586. As we mentioned earlier, Cecil had been looking for a pretext to put Mary to death from the beginning, and now he had it. Mary did not hide the fact that she had always sought means to escape. Indeed, she had every right to do so, as she was being detained unlawfully. However, she denied she had ever been involved in any kind of plot to kill Elizabeth. In her own words, she protested her innocence and claimed that she had not procured or encouraged any hurt against Her Majesty. She contended that as Queen of Scotland, she did not incur any responsibility for the plotting of English subjects. Cecil ignored all of this, including her royal privilege, and had her condemned to death anyway. Even Elizabeth herself was reluctant to go ahead with the execution, but Cecil was too powerful for her. In Fotheringay Castle, Northamptonshire, when the fateful day of her execution arrived, the 8th of February, 1587, Mary was well prepared to meet her maker. She composed a prayer in Latin before she died. A translation of it was made into the English language a couple of centuries later by John Fawcett. O merciful Father, my hope is in thee. O gracious Redeemer, deliver thou me. My bondage bemoaning, with sorrowful groaning, I long to be free. Lamenting, relenting, and humbly repenting, O Jesu, my Saviour, I languish for thee. The execution was carried out by beheading. Before she died, Mary prayed, "As thy arms, O God, were stretched upon the cross, so receive me into the arms of thy mercy, and forgive me my sins." The killing of an anointed sovereign, and the legitimate Queen of England at that, shocked all of Christendom. In Spain, King Philip was prompted to launch the ill-fated Armada. Later in that same year, 1587, the Pope would give the red hat to Dr. William Allen, the same Dr. Allen who helped to establish the English colleges in Douay and Rome for the benefit of English seminarians, and which became the seabed of many martyrs. In bestowing the red hat, the Pope said that he had meant to console English Catholics for the loss of Mary. It seems fitting that we should give the last word to the English Jesuit poet and martyr, St. Robert Southwell, a contemporary of Mary, who paid tribute to her in verse. Alive a queen, now dead I am a saint. Once Mary called, my name now martyr is. From earthly reign, debarred by restraint, in lieu whereof I reign in heavenly bliss. Rue not my death, rejoice at my repose. It was no death to me, but to my woe. The bud was opened to let out the rose, the chains unloosed to let the captive go. This episode of the history program was researched and presented by Frost Solanas for Gate of Heaven Radio. We hope you have enjoyed it and will join us again next month for another episode of the history program. Ave Maria.